When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hannah baby. Introducing a new collection, Hannah Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hannah quality for your most precious gift. Hannah Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannahanderson.com.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Judging Megan with your host, Megan Judge. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I do have some rocking new guitar in the beginning of my show. I'm kind of like switching around my music to see if I can find a different one. I was thinking, because a lot of people don't know this about me, but I think a decent imitation of Tina Turner. So I was kind of thinking, I don't know what you guys think, but I've been looking for a new direction that I had to search. What do you think? What do you think? Lucky's already on. What do you think, Lucky?
Round of applause.
You guys, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I won't do that to you. And also my husband gets really embarrassed because at every wedding, when I maybe have had too much buttery Chardonnay, I tend to want to get up on stage and do my Tina Turner impression. And he usually leaves the location at that point and is embarrassed. So if I'm changing around my music, I unfortunately don't have the rights to Tina Turner. She's the queen. I wish I did. But I am playing around with some new music in case anyone noticed. But I am ready to start the show. This podcast has been brought to you by the brand new Hysterical podcast by Scott and Liam Kelly. They are a father and son team, and they came up with this great idea to talk about different sayings that people say, like jump off the bandwagon and cart before the horse. And they kind of talk about like funny stories about things that Liam used to say as a kid. I know that it affected me because my daughter Ella used to say things like, "Mom, bring the McPewter instead of the computer." So to this day, we still say McPewter. They just have such a great relationship, and listening to the podcast just made me laugh. So check out the brand new podcast, Why Do We Say That? And I hope you enjoy it. So everyone, I'm really fortunate and excited to have my guest on today, Lucky Nua. He and I met, I guess Lucky had reached out to me after one of my first podcasts with Dr. Nay. And he's just an incredible person. We started chatting and talking to each other, and we've both kind of gone through similar journeys in a lot of ways. Lucky has dealt with depression and anxiety throughout his life. And I actually came on Lucky's show. He has a show on YouTube. What is your show called, Lucky?
Yeah, it's called the Mental Health Chats, and it's under the YouTube channel, Mental Health Casual. So,
okay. And, And Lucky's such a good interviewer and such a,
I appreciate
you're
it.
You're not a kid, but to me, I feel like a grandma. You're a young, smart man. I'll say that because I don't want to call you a kid.
I'll take it.
But thank you so much, and welcome to my show.
Oh, it's great to be on. I really appreciate you you returning the favor. And yeah, it was actually me that asked to be on your podcast first, but you know, you were backed up a little bit, so we decided to kind of go with mine, since I have a pretty open schedule, since yeah, I've taken some time off from work to kind of pursue these the podcasting, the YouTubing, and all these crazy ideas that I had. So still trying to cultivate those right now. But yeah, I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, something I love about you is you're very open about what you've gone through in your life. And I found that men are not necessarily, especially young men, are not necessarily as open to talking about depression and mental health as women are. And I've been lucky enough to meet a few people like you and a guest that I have coming on next week as well, that like me want to break the stigma against mental health. I said it yesterday. I was on somebody else's podcast, and I was talking about if you broke your arm, right? Would you like let your arm go flailing about and not wear a cast? Mm. Probably not, right? You would take care of it and get a cast and be put on medication for the pain. Kind of the same thing with our brains, you know? And the fact that people are so judgmental about people that are suffering from any kind of depression, anything like that, I know it's my goal to end that. And I know that that's really important to you, and your voice is so important and so needs to be heard in this world. So again, I appreciate you. I appreciate everything you're putting out there, and I'm just really excited and thankful to have you on my show. So why don't we start with, like, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? And where you grew up and where you were born, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I was born in Santa Clara, California, but pretty much right next to San Jose, California. And if anybody's familiar with Silicon Valley, that's where that is all located. And so I grew up there. My father and my mom divorced. I think it was around when I was five, but I was in preschool time right there. My dad was pretty abusive. But that wasn't uncommon for the Samoan culture. You know, corporal punishment is still a very big use in terms of discipline in that culture. But I think as generations go on, they're starting to see some of the effects of it. So, and also the studies are coming out that it's very detrimental. But
Can I stop you right there? So mm-hmm. When you say that, in the Samoan culture, abuse mm-hmm. is prevalent. Between parents, fathers, and sons.
It's usually because in the Samoan culture, elders are to be respected, and if it's not upheld, it's almost seen as a sign of disrespect. Whereas, you know, maybe in more Western culture, or you know, American culture, or you know, pretty much a lot of other cultures, you'd see it as, oh, this is a phase, you know. Whereas Samoans, it seems like it's more of a nipping in the bud sort of thing before it even happens. And so, you know, when a lot of us, and my mom is not Samoan, we're, you know, my I'm half Samoan from my dad's side. So my mom was never okay with it. And even when, you know, they were sharing custody of me, she made it very clear that it was not like if they hit me, like I wasn't going over there anymore. And so, yeah, it was still pretty prevalent. You know, even when I was over there, I'd see other, like my cousins getting hit. I still did get hit a little bit. But you know, not nearly as much as some of my cousins or people that actually had, you know, fathers over there. My dad was kind of in and out of that place, 'cause, he would bring me over to my Uncle Lay's house, and, he was like the patriarch of the family. And so, you know, I would go there. I'd be pretty scared a lot of times, because my dad would just walk, you know, drive off and go do his thing, while my Samoan family would take care of me. And so, yeah, it was pretty interesting, kind of living in both worlds. You know, living in a typical, you know, in my mom's family, where it was not, you know, nobody got hit. Sure, there are arguments and all that kind of stuff, but you know, I'd never raised that level. So I never felt I always felt safe with my mom. And so, you know, I went through that for a lot of my life. And then eventually, somewhere around middle school, my father moved about 3 hours away over to a place called Patterson. And so you know, effectively, it kind of just stopped us seeing each other for a long time. And he would see me every now and then, but not too often. It was very, very, very rare. And so eventually that kind of leads up to when I was in high school, and this is where the defining moment comes in, about senior year, I graduated. I was, you know, I had my first girlfriend. Everything was looking up. And then my father kind of said something to my mom because I decided to go to San Jose City Community College instead of San Jose State University, which is a four-year university. And my father kind of said to my mom off to the side, you know, hey, you know, why isn't he going to a real school? Why isn't he going to university? And so that just flipped me out because my whole life, my dad had always kind of always been on me, you know, oh, why do you weigh this much? Why don't you trim your beard? Why don't you have a beard? You know, it was just like all these very conflicting things. And so when he said that it set me off and I started doing things like punching walls, walking. I'd walk for like 3 hours a day, but just at night because it kind of soothed me. But at the same time, it was just thoughts racing in my head. I wanted to be somewhere else all the time.
When you were a kid and you were getting, when you say you were physically beaten, at what age did that start?
I know I was in diapers. That's the earliest I can remember. But my mom had to work two jobs, so because my dad wasn't working at the time, so he got us most of the time. And I have two other siblings, but we all come from different fathers. And so, you know, he also disciplined them, and they also had a really, really tough time with him as well.
You were in diapers, I talk about this a lot. The amount of trauma when you're that age that you bring into your adult life and again, I'm no therapist. I just know this from myself. Mm-hmm. You bring it into your adult life and you kind of push these things down. And it sounds to me like it was extremely traumatic for you to grow up with a father that was abusive. Was it just physical or was it emotional as well?
It was emotional, but I feel like my brother and my sister probably got the majority of that. I was the youngest out of all three of us. And so also I happened to be the favorite of my grandmother on my father's side. So he was the baby of his family. And so, you know, anytime I was over there and she was around, like nobody could hit me. It was like she would not let anybody hit me at that point. And, you know, it's interesting that you know, we're talking about how trauma can kind of affect us. It's interesting. One of the biggest senses that we have is our sense of smell. And every time I go to McDonald's, there's that like apple pie thing that they have. She used to have a lip gloss that smelled exactly like McDonald's. And so I used to just always order the apple pies. And every time I'd eat an apple pie, I'd feel like calm and safe whenever I was with him because he'd take me to McDonald's all the time. And so every time he'd be like, oh yeah, what do you want? And I was like, oh, I'd get an apple pie. And he'd usually make fun of me for, you know, overeating and all that stuff. But, you know, that it always made me feel a little bit safer with him. And
because you thought of your grandmother.
Exactly. The lip gloss that she had on.
That's amazing. And it's so true that senses affect us in so many ways. When you say that this is prevalent in the Samoan culture, and I know I'm not saying Samoan like you do. I wish I could say it.
That's fine.
It sounds so much better when you say it. I'm like not saying it correctly. But are you heavily involved in with other families of that background? And you said that you saw that often with friends. And just to backpedal a little bit, you're saying that that's changing now. Like it's not accepted, because that's shocking to me, just hearing that that's an accepted thing. I'm shocked to hear that.
Yeah, and it's literally just kind of the culture shock of it. Like if you go over to you know, we actually visited American Samoa back in 2010, maybe I was a junior in high school, and yeah, the culture was completely different, right? You know, you have everything's very strict, you know, strict in terms of like everybody has a role to do. And that's why, you know, so you hear about, you know, Samoans getting into sports and stuff, right? That was because that's the only thing they have to do over there. Like the kids, So it's really good if you're ever, if people ever think about moving over there, it's better if you're like retired because there's great fishing spots, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the water's blue, you know, everything like that. But as a kid, you know, you really want to get out of there. You really want to get to, you know, you really want to get picked up by a college team or something like that and get out of there so that you can, you know, have a little bit more, agency. But the thing, the problem with that agency is because they're restricted so much, and you see this a lot with, you know, heavy conservative people. You know, I had Dr. Ney's assistant Clara on, right? And she came from that very heavy conservative background. And they ended up, once she kind of branched out, it was like, oh, there's all this stuff. And you didn't get slowly introduced to it because you didn't really understand. And there was this whole other world, right? And so when all of a sudden these Samoans get out of that culture, they're like, oh, now I have all this freedom. And instead of the parents introducing some freedom to them so that they can know what to do when they how to handle it, they end up finding drugs. You know, obesity is on the rise. I've been keeping track of this for a while, but I know we've been in at least the top 10 conversation of top obese people in the world per capita for at least since the 80s, I think. And you know,
is it the way that people eat? Is it your From what I understand, the little bit that I know about your culture is it's accepted to be bigger, correct? Or no? Am I wrong?
Yeah. No, that's okay. Definitely a big thing. Actually, my cousin, who's very, very skinny, he's about my height, but probably weighs like 160 pounds. So I'm 6'3". So that's very skinny. And he was always telling me, especially when I started ballooning up at one point, letting myself go, he was like, oh man, dude, you're looking big. And he was always, you know, looking at me like that. I was like, bro, I'd kill to have your body, man. It's not cool to be this like this. But, you know, yeah, to answer your question, yeah, it is mostly accepted. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you play sports so much and when you're young and you can kind of metabolize all this stuff that you just grow up with that. You know, I remember they had back in Samoa, there was these big jugs of water. And I was like, where'd you get these jugs from? It's like, oh yeah, those were originally jars of mayonnaise. And I was like, what? This is like a gallon of mayonnaise. What do you need that for? And you know, my brother and I weren't used to it. We had to actually ask them to stop putting so much mayonnaise on everything. And you know, the thing is when you grow up around that, you're not really growing up. And I think another thing is, you know, bringing this back to like mental health and stuff, right? It also comes with that too. Like whenever we talk about mental health in that culture, it's almost seen as, oh, you're too white, you know, you're westernizing, you know, us or something like that. Like it's exclusive to Western culture, like mental health and physical health, like, you know, getting on a diet and all that stuff. And, you know, I think the mindset is just wrong from the get-go.
Do you think that, cause you were talking about how you were kind of like Americanized and then because of your mom, and then you were like dealing with both worlds. And we kind of, in the very beginning, talked about, you know, skipped ahead to you being teased by your dad about mm-hmm. your weight. And, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think that confuses me a little bit, because if he was used to that, why was he teasing you about your appearance for being bigger?
Yeah, well, actually, funny enough, he was one of the only Samoans that wasn't super. He was actually very built for a long time. He in his heyday, he could bench like 550 pounds, and so he was always used to, you know, getting all this attention. I think that's why he ended up being a philanderer. A lot of women paid him a lot of attention, you know, and you know, a lot of them thought he played on like the San Francisco 49ers for a long time because there was a Samoan player that was on there, and you know, I think a lot of that kind of got to his head because I think he was bullied pretty heavily for being the youngest in that family for a long time. And so when you kind of get bullied that long, you kind of want to enact that on somebody else. And I think I just don't think he had a good he didn't have a chance to mature in life. And you know, funny enough, later on in his life he eventually kind of turned to religion and actually found a woman that would beat the crap out of him if he tried anything. He ended up marrying a Samoan woman after my mom. And I heard some stories and she does not take any crap from anybody. So, you know, it was interesting to see the shoe on the other foot, but he really did need somebody like that to humble him, to make sure to go back to kind of what you were saying about, you know, being, you know, him kind of teasing me about my weight and all that stuff. You know, it's interesting because I didn't think I was that big until he said it. And then I was like, oh, like what in the world is going on? You know?
And what age was that? Because you also said that it's a normal, like accepted thing. Like everybody plays sports. And were you teased because you weren't playing sports, or how did that go?
Yeah, good question. A little bit because it's very common for Samoans to play football in high school, and at first I tried to, but then I realized I just didn't want to do it. I just didn't see the benefit in it. And not saying that, you know, if you play football, you're, you know, anything like that, but it just didn't seem like the right thing to me. So eventually I actually got into band. And so I did end up on the field, but I was a trombone player for the marching band. And so,
which is amazing, by the way. Shout out, yeah. Band. I always wanted to be in the band, but I wanted to be one of those like baton twirler girls in the front.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
I never lived out that dream, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I think, I kind of defied a lot of expectations for him, but in his eyes, I think it was more like I was dropping below them than anything else. You know, he always wanted me to work out and to get bigger and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's funny enough, you know, before he did pass away, he did actually give me some good advice that actually stuck with me. And I still apply today in terms of lifting weights and stuff. But when he was in that mindset, I just don't think he knew how to say it. Like I said, it was a maturity thing. He just didn't get a chance to mature the same way that a lot of people do. And I'm starting to realize that now as I go through some of that baggage that, you know, has been building up over the years. And, it definitely still comes back to me, but I also have to look at it through the other lens, or else I would be just like him, right? I wouldn't.
Yeah. So you're trying to, everything you're doing is breaking. It's all about breaking cycles, right? So if your dad was dealing with, you know, abuse from his dad, if it was common in the culture, then obviously if you don't work on it, it's going to repeat itself. Do you think that he also put a lot more pressure on you just being a boy, right? A lot of times parents, men, want their kids to play sports. Do you think that you felt like he was teasing you because you were a little bit different that way?
Yeah. And I think also I got a lot of pressure put on me. So I'm actually, he named me after his nickname. So his actual name is Onge. But when he came here, so it's spelled O-G-E, but in the Samoan culture, when you have a G, you put an N before it. So instead of O-G-E becoming O-G, it's Onge. And so, you know, when he came over here, he decided, oh, you know, I'll go by my nickname, Lucky. Well, he didn't spell it the American way. He spelled it the Samoan way. So that's why my name is L-A-K-I. And when I was born, he ended up naming me after him. And, I always saw that as like a really big curse. For the longest time, I wanted to change my name. I wanted to change it to like the American Lucky, you know, L-U-C-K-Y, to distance myself from him. But now I've kind of seen it as a challenge to retake that name and make something great out of it. You know, instead of being like this burden that he's put on me, I've decided to kind of take it and kind of turn it into, because, you know, my when I went to Samoa, we stopped in Hawaii to go visit my uncle over there, and a lot of them knew my dad is Crazy Lucky. That's what they knew him as. You know, he kind of went off the handle. He was doing drugs. He got into cocaine and marijuana and all that stuff. And eventually he got to the point where I think in his 40s, early 40s, I think he was wearing dentures at that point. And so, yeah, he really messed himself up. And that was actually, I think that was the demise of him. Also the bad diet, because he was on dialysis later in his life and passed away when he was 60. So, you know, it definitely all kind of came around.
How long ago did that happen? Did he pass away?
It was 2017.
Okay, so not that long ago. Mm-hmm. Well, I think all of this stuff makes sense why you would have gotten to the point where we kind of touched on, where you got into high school. And then you were going to the community college, which was a letdown to him. Do you want to talk about when you started having issues with your anxiety and depression? Was that really the time that you started dealing with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've definitely always had problems with social anxiety in particular. I've always been very quiet. I actually, in middle school, in I think eighth grade, I got put into the advanced drama program, you know, where they do all the plays and stuff. And I told the teacher, I was like, I didn't sign up for this. And she was like, I know a lot of people got put in here randomly, but you know, if you want to give it a shot, you know, you're more than welcome to. And you know, I gave it a shot. And so I ended up, you know, auditioning for the first play. You have to choose like three people that you maybe want to do. And the third one was always like one of the top people or something, like one of the main people. And I was like, okay, I don't want that one.
So you didn't want to be the lead.
Yeah. So she ended up making me the lead of both plays. So I ended up being the lead in the first play, and I ended up kind of the lead. There were a lot of different leads. And then I ended up being the main villain for the second play. And the second play, I ended up just, you know, one of the other people ended up wanting to switch with me. He was playing like a J. Jonah Jameson from Spider-Man, you know, very grumpy boss character. And I was playing Dr. Shock Clock, who was, you know, a guy who could snap his fingers and stop time and all that stuff. And, you know, we begged my teacher to, you know, hey, can you please change it? And she's like, you know what? My decision is final, but if you guys, you know, Lucky, if you really do not want this role, if you really don't, yeah, and she got flipped on me. She's like, oh, if you really don't have faith in my decision making, I was like, ah, crap, okay, I guess I'll do it. And, you know, it actually kind of gave me my voice a little bit, because my grandfather actually went there, and he, when he saw that play, he was like, I don't think I've ever heard you say more words in my life, you know, in my whole existence at that point. And after that, I started kind of getting out of my shell a little bit. But going forward to, you know, kind of what we were alluding to, in high school, I started branching out a little bit, but the social anxiety kind of switched from anxiety before the events to the anxiety after the events, the judgment, the harshness of myself, the judging and all that stuff. And, you know, I was
so
in a mariachi.
You were judging yourself at that
exactly.
point.
Yeah.
You were critical of what about yourself?
So, I mean, just everything. Anytime I would go off script because it felt good in the moment. An example would be, I was in a mariachi band, and you know, we had the charro suits, everything going on, and this wasn't supposed to happen, but I just kind of, it was our last performance. I was a senior, so my girlfriend was in the crowd, my mom was in the crowd, and all this stuff. So I just decided, you know what, to hell with it. I jumped off the stage and I started dancing with the folklorico dancers in front, and you know, just started, you know, kind of doing that. And I realized that I wanted to. You know, I just wanted to kind of be free. And I was like, but then afterwards I was like, oh my God, what did I do? I just made an ass of myself. And you know, I ended up sitting in a corner just thinking about that. Right. And that's just how I was back then. Right.
But you saying these things, I'm like, Lucky, you're like kind of a badass. Like you didn't take the road that everyone else takes in life, where it's like, you're a boy and you go and you play football. You did the band, and you were in a mariachi band, by the way. I don't know anybody that has been in a mariachi band. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, and I was, funny enough, I was the only one that I remember. Yeah, I was the only one that wasn't, I have no, like, Latin descent, you know, no Mexican descent on my side. But, you know, I got called in to play trombone for something that they were doing for a banda, which has a lot of brass instruments in it. And, you know, I was like, oh, this music is great. I'm gonna start doing this. And, you know, I was always a very ambitious person, but the problem was, after the ambitious part would happen, that's when I would start judging myself. And so
you would start judging yourself. Do you feel like me? I mean, cause you know, I told you I was an actress when I was younger, and I found that I would escape into my characters.
Yeah.
And so it sounds to me like you're very, very right brained, like I am. Mm-hmm. You know, very creative, and you like music. I have a passion for music. Like, it sounds like you do. And I loved to go into and like find myself being free when I could be somebody else. And it kind of sounds to me like you felt that way. But then when you would snap out of it, like you said, or get out of like jumping off the stage and being free, you would doubt yourself. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And I think to add on to that, I think it also had a lot to do with my dad. You know, anytime I felt like I went outside the boundaries, it was almost like his gaze became my gaze, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden I wasn't sticking to the script. I wasn't doing the things that I should be doing. I was doing something that could embarrass me, you know, in the long run. And, you know, and all of a sudden it just became like, because my dad wasn't there anymore to really put this judgment on me, it became my job to do it in my own mind, and to kind of keep me in check, because I didn't really have a plan. I mean, I think that's what a lot of people don't realize about not having your father in your life as a young man, is he's supposed to give you some type of blueprint, you know, not exactly like a map to show you exactly where to go, but at least show you where the milestones are and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But since I didn't have that, I didn't know where I was going. So it was almost like walking in a sandstorm. You know, you just keep going and going. You're hoping for an oasis, and every now and then you get one. But then once you get to that oasis, nobody ever talks about what happens afterwards. You still have to go back to that desert and then go back and try and find another one, or at least try and find something. And that's how a lot of my days were in high school, because, you know, everybody had their major figured out. You know, I was like, I have no idea what I'm going to do. And so, you know, and that kind of leads into, you know, my depression and my anxiety. So one day, eventually I was, you know, one day I was having really a lot of trouble sleeping, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden
this was in high school.
It was right after, yeah, it was high school. I think it was right after I graduated. So in May. And
okay,
then,
so going into college.
Yeah, exactly.
Going into the community college. Okay.
Yeah. And so I just woke up and the room was red. There was red writing on the wall that said hopeless. And I was like, this is a crazy dream. This is weird. And I started hearing voices in my head. It was just saying, you know, all kinds of stuff that I can't really say on here, but you know, I was seeing myself do things to myself in front of me. Like it was like I could see it in front of me happening. And so I remember just crying and closing my eyes, but I realized it wasn't a dream anymore. I was literally seeing this all happen in front of me. And so I eventually got to sleep. I think I was up for about 2 hours experiencing that. And so, eventually my sleep got really bad, and that's, a lot of people don't realize this, but that's usually when a lot of the hallucinations happen for anybody, is when you're not sleeping well. So, you know, that's a little tip for everybody. Just get a good night's sleep, because the downside is definitely bad.
Were you, when that happened to you, and that was the first time it happened, had mm-hmm. you been experimenting with like drugs or alcohol or something that would bring something like that on, or was just out of the blue?
Yeah, funny enough, that's actually more intense than when I got into drugs later in life. I had not done any of that stuff. It literally just been, I mean, also I have a very active imagination. Like when all those times being quiet, I was just kind of imagining myself in another world all the time, you know, imagining myself as the main character of this and that. And just because reality seemed so cruel that it didn't seem like, you know, this was the reality I was given. I just wanted to reject it. And, you know, eventually I got to the point where one day I just had this really severe panic attack, and I was just like, oh my God. And eventually I got to the point where I just stopped talking. I couldn't talk anymore. And
let me stop you right there.
Yeah,
so you had that experience with seeing red, and then was that considered a panic attack, or what was that considered, an episode? What was that?
It was more like a manic episode.
A manic episode. Okay.
Yeah, that was what they told me at the hospital.
Did you go to the hospital at that point when you were seeing the red? Like what were?
No, funny enough, that was probably like 2 or 3 weeks before I actually ended up eventually going to the hospital. And
were
I had
you,
that experience.
Were you living with your mom at the time, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so your mom was there when you were experiencing that.
Yeah, well, she didn't know about the hallucination part of it until you know, the next part of this where I, you know, I ended up having the panic attack and I couldn't speak because, you know, she was talking to me, but I couldn't say anything to her. And I realized like, it was almost like somebody was covering up my mouth with their hand, and I just couldn't say anything. And I was like, what in the world is going on?
But when did you, just trying to make a timeline here. So you had that episode, and then like you woke up the next day after not really sleeping, like you said, and then you seemed to be fine. Or did you start to have panic attacks 2 weeks later, but you didn't know what they were? What was the timeline?
Yeah. So I probably only had like 2 or 3 panic attacks, but only one that I can vividly remember. And the next day I kind of just shrugged it off like, oh man, that was a crazy dream, even though I know it wasn't a dream, but I wanted it to be a dream. So I just kind of said to myself, it was a dream. And the only reason why I know it wasn't a dream was because I can remember everything about it pretty much till today. You know, I can remember exactly where I was laying. I can remember my hands. You know, usually that's a common thing, is you look at your hand if in your dream so you can lucid dream, because there usually won't be definition on it, so you can kind of get yourself out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remembered everything about it. And so, you know, eventually, you know, going forward, I think this was about June. That was back in May. And so June, I ended up, you know, having this panic attack that led me to, you know, being quiet, and I couldn't say anything. So my mom was about like 5 feet away from me, and I ended up texting her, you know, and she was like, you know, what do you need? And I was like, I need help. I didn't know what to.
Like you couldn't speak. How long ago was this, by the way?
This was back in 2011. So, or okay. 2011. Yeah, that was, that's when I graduated.
Okay, so you couldn't speak. And it's interesting because, you know, I've talked openly about suffering from panic attacks, but everybody suffers in different ways. Like there's people that, like for me, I couldn't breathe. I thought it was dying. But you just couldn't understand, you couldn't comprehend how to get your voice out. Were you having problems breathing? Like what were your other symptoms?
Yeah. So the problems breathing happened before that. And then, you know, but my mom was right next to me because I was in the living room for a long time. And so, you know, she was just on the computer next to me, but I didn't want her to hear this. So I tried to make my breathing even shallower so she couldn't hear it. And I ended up, you know, it just kind of stopped me. And I realized there were so many thoughts in my head that I couldn't pick out words anymore. Like I think you had a pretty good allusion to this. You had mentioned like a one of those old school freezers kind of, you know, when it sounds like it's shutting down.
Yeah, when I was on your YouTube show, when I was having such horrible panic attacks, I would be in my bed, you know, at night, and I would doze off, right? So I would be what I thought was asleep, but then all of a sudden I would just like be like, oh, and I couldn't breathe. And I would hit my husband who was sitting next to me. And I, like what you said, like what I had said on your show was it felt like an old refrigerator just completely going, like shutting down and going, and then like going back on. It was crazy. Yep. So you didn't have those symptoms or you did?
I definitely did, but like I said, there was more to it. Like instead of it taking over me, I still had some consciousness to the point where I tried to suppress it more. And that's what eventually led me to like my thoughts just going around so fast that I couldn't pick out words anymore. It's almost like if your listeners can like imagine a tornado happening full of words and trying to pick out a word from it, right? And just, I couldn't find them anymore. I was so lost. And so but that was only when it came to my voice. Like I could still text things because it was like a physical, you know, you have Dr. Ney on a lot, you know, she talks about somatic psychotherapy and stuff. And, you know, the physical sensation of touching the buttons actually kind of soothed me a little bit because it made me feel like I could speak again. But, you know, eventually I had to ask my mom to, you know, for help. And so she.
So was that just one panic attack that you were like, I have to go to the hospital? It was that bad?
Yeah, that was exactly it. And so, you know, she ended up driving me.
So what happened at the hospital? What did they say?
Yeah, so I went to the emergency room. Eventually I did get back to speaking just because I think I was in a different environment. There were different people talking to me. And so eventually I was able to like talk and, you know, but they put me under what's called a 5150, and it's a hold that the hospital can put on you if you're a danger to yourself or others. And I was a danger to myself at that point. They eventually took me over to luckily there was an on-site place, right around the corner from it, where they do the inpatient procedure, where the psych ward is, mental health hospital, whatever you want to call it. And I was put in there roughly maybe around 10 or 11. I think it's very late at night. And, you know, I started talking to all these psychologists and they were just saying, hey, you know, I just realized something just kept coming up, which was my father. I just kept on mentioning him and I still remember thinking to myself like, oh, does my dad have something to do with this? It was very strange that I had the wherewithal.
But why did they think that you were a danger to yourself? Had you said that you wanted to kill yourself or had you?
I was crying pretty profoundly and I still was having trouble speaking. And, you know, I was kind of asking them, or, you know, they were kind of asking me like, you know, is there something that you need? And I was like, I just don't know. I was having a lot of trouble with that. And like I said, I wasn't able to speak about like until about an hour into being at the hospital. Right. And so that was, so they kind of picked up on a lot of that stuff. And, they had no, also she kind of said, you know, the nurse was very nice, or sorry, the doctor was very nice that put me under that 5150. She said, you know, I'm going to put you under 5150, you know, for your own sake. I do want to let you know though, that, you know, you won't be able to do this, you know, you can't own a gun for 5 years. You can't, do this. And I said to her, okay, you know, I knew
that that was good for you. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
to be responsible enough with like caring about other people and yourself, you obviously knew you were holding yourself responsible enough to be like, yeah, I need this. Whereas a lot of times people won't admit that, right? If they need to be, they'll fight it. So yeah. that takes a lot of bravery to be able to say, I need this.
Yeah. And, you know, so I went through the whole thing, and, you know, I always describe it as like Dr. Drew's celebrity rehab. Like you have a roommate that's always weird. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I had a very interesting roommate that just slept all day and didn't exactly know what his deal was until a little bit later. But, you know, I kind of went through that whole process, and, you know,
How long were you in there?
3 days.
Okay.
And not nearly as long as some people do, but, you know, I was diagnosed with major depression, social anxiety, and mania because of the hallucinations. Eventually got onto Zoloft and Risperidol, which is an antipsychotic. And, you know, that was doing pretty well for me. I eventually found a therapist that he had suffered from social anxiety as well and was an expert in it. So he helped me a lot. You know, my first therapist was like really profound on me. And, you know, eventually it got to the point where I took a little break from therapy, and, you know, I was just like, oh, you know, I think I'm doing pretty good. I'd gone for therapy for about like two years after that. And so,
was like the time I always talk about timelines just so. Yeah. The audience can understand. So that was like 2011 to 2013. And then you decide you were on the medication successfully. Mm-hmm. Did you continue to have the panic attacks and the hallucinations, or was the medicine kind of like keeping you in place?
Yeah. So the medicine was keeping me in place. And eventually I actually got off of the medication. My psychiatrist had actually recommended that to me, because I wasn't, you know, when you go to the therapist, you always give these 0 to 3 answers. Like, how often have you had any thoughts of wanting to hurt yourself? 0, 1, 2, 3. You know, in the last a lot in the last, you know, whatever days, and a lot in the last 2 weeks, something like that. And my scores were pretty low, and even my therapist and him were talking a lot, and they hadn't really seen a lot from me. So they kind of deemed it okay for me to kind of go on my own for a little bit. And if I ever did need to come back, I had his number and all that kind of stuff. And so,
did they wean you off? I would assume they weaned you off. Okay.
Yeah. So I was taking, I think, 2 Risperidol tablets. I can't remember exactly the dosage now that I'm thinking about it, but eventually I got off they got me off of the Risperidol first, because it raised my cholesterol. That was one of the side effects that happened. And, you know, I was already a big guy as it was. So that was one thing they definitely wanted to wean me off of. And then the Zoloft eventually came off after that. And so, I was actually doing very well, but in the Bay Area, it's very, popular to smoke weed. And, my friends were no exception. I eventually kind of got into that, and I don't have a lot against weed. I just have a lot against me doing weed, because I was a sun up till sundowner. I would smoke it at work. And for people that don't know, you know, I was working in retail where I used to drive forklifts and all that kind of stuff. So I was always high, you know.
So it sounds like you went from kind of like being under control, being on these medications, they were helping you to the point where you didn't need them, but you probably really still did need them. But then instead you turned to what a lot of times people do to like cope is marijuana, alcohol, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it had to do with my social situation, you know, my social anxiety and all that stuff, because everybody else was doing it around me and I felt left out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to feel like I belonged there. And, you know, eventually I did that. And
was that not good for you? Because for some people, they cannot smoke pot because it makes them super paranoid and it can make things even worse. So is that what happened with you?
Funny enough, I actually liked the paranoia. That's a problem. I'm a very interesting person in the fact that I like it when things are out of control, because it feels exhilarating. In fact, you know, for people that don't know, so like when you eat an edible, you know, edible marijuana, usually like 20 milligrams is good for like a normal person to kind of feel kind of okay. 75 is when it starts to get kind of into like, oh my God, I'm really stoned. You know, 100, you know, all that kind of stuff. I eventually got to the point where I was able to eat like 300 milligrams, and I used to do that every Friday and just trip balls for all that Friday and feel great. I was like, oh my God, let's go to the mall, or, you know, I want to get the crap scared out of me. You know, it was ridiculous. I really liked the chaos, and that's always what I've always liked. Even when I was heavily drinking, which kind of around the same time, you know, I liked drinking and driving because I liked not knowing what was going to happen next. And I needed that exhilaration.
That's so scary.
Yeah.
It does make sense. I mean, mm-hmm. I personally never, I definitely like to drink wine, but yeah. I can't get to the point to ever understand like pot or any of that stuff. Cause the couple times in my life that I have smoked pot, I'm always somebody that gets super paranoid, but it does make sense for you because you're so creative mm-hmm. that you would want to go into that place. So what made you kind of stop smoking? Did you hit a wall?
Yeah, it was mostly just because even the people that smoked a lot were saying like, man, he smokes a lot. It was crazy. Yeah. You know, I was, and also the money was a big thing. You know, I'd spend maybe $120 a week.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, because I smoked so much, you know, to give paint people a picture, I used to smoke like a blunt a day by myself, you know, and that's a lot of weed. You know, a gram is about enough to make a blunt, and a gram is roughly about $10 a gram. It's roughly about $10 a gram. So that's about $50 down the drain by Friday, right? And that's not including the time that I
party. You obviously considered yourself as having an addiction.
Yeah, at that point, but I was like every other stoner that said, oh yeah, I can quit whenever I want to. But then, you know, I just don't want to quit, you know, just everybody kind of said the same thing. And, you know, eventually it just got to the point where I realized I didn't like my job at that point. I was having a lot of trouble with one of the managers. And I actually, this is where my religion kind of comes into play. I begged God. I was like, if you can be with me when I go into that office and tell him I'm quitting, like, I swear to God, I'm never going to smoke again. And, you know, lo and behold, I went to the office, no 2 weeks notice or no nothing. And I just kind of went in there and said, you know, I can't do this. I need to work on myself. And, you know, to their credit, they were very nice about it. They decided to put on my record if I ever did want to go back, you know, that I gave them my 2 weeks notice so I can always be hired back there, so that it didn't seem like we got off on the wrong foot or anything like that. Because I'd worked there for about 7 years and had always been, you know, pretty like a willing employee. And so, you know, they definitely hooked it up with that.
Do you feel like any regrets about any of the decisions like you talked about? And I'm not judging you, although this is judging, Megan, not to be silly. But like you talk about like the drinking and driving and some of those kinds of things, you know, like obviously you're putting other people's lives at risk by doing that. Do you look back and say, like, maybe I shouldn't have done those things, or do you have any regrets? Yeah. Or do you really think that it was just stemming from your mental, mental differences? I like to say that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to look at it in the context of my life. You know, I really wanted to die at that point. You know, I've always, I think between the ages of 19 and 25, I was the most suicidal. And there were times where I just really wanted to die. It just got to that point. And so with the drinking and driving thing, the problem with all of this though, Megan, is the fact that I didn't think about other people. I didn't think about the fact that if I did drink and drive and I hit somebody, I always thought, oh yeah, I could just die. That's fine. I never really thought about the other person at the other side of that. And so
that's not to talk over you, but that's very valid because it shows what a dark place you were in. Right. Mm-hmm. And when I've talked openly about my story is different, but you know, you're in this place of like being suicidal and you don't really think about other people. You just think, I just want this to stop. I just want this. You talk about being spiritual. I'm spiritual as well. Mm-hmm. You know, just have this pain go away. Is that how you were feeling?
Yeah, and I felt like I couldn't do it on my own. So if I did it through some accident, it wouldn't, you know, nobody could blame themselves. Nobody could, when I was gone, nobody could, you know, look at me differently and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, looking back on it now, I definitely wouldn't want to do it. But the fact is that it did happen. So I don't look at it with, I don't look at it exactly with shame or anything like that. I definitely look at it as I can't go back there because it's detrimental to my health, my overall health at this point. And that's kind of what always go through my mind whenever I'm at the HEB supermarket over here in Texas. And I, you know, all of a sudden I'll stroll next to the alcohol aisle and I'll see all the stuff that I used to get, the Mickey's, 40s, the, you know, Miller High Life, all that kind of stuff. Every time I look down the aisle, I just remember kind of instinctively used to just grabbing a six pack that I always used to get and always being able to just do that and kind of listen to my muscle memory and just go, oh, yep, I got this one. And, mm-hmm. you know, always kind of remembering that in the back of my head. But yeah, you know,
Do you not drink anymore?
Yeah, I'm completely sober. I haven't drank for about a year and a half and I haven't smoked for about 3 years.
Well, that's great. So when you got out of that time period mm-hmm. and you left your job, did you go back into therapy? Did you realize like you needed help again? Did you go back on medication?
Actually, I went back into therapy before that, and that's actually what led me to quitting that job. But in quitting that job, I actually lost that therapist. I lost that therapist actually before that because he was thinking about moving up somewhere else, and you know, it seems like he's doing pretty good, so great for him. But no, I haven't really been back in therapy for pretty long while, but I definitely still use a lot of the mechanisms that I use in there. And also, I'm actually still a lot, like my grandmother passed away last November, and it hit us all really hard. And so I eventually got to the point where I just kind of got up and I started calling my relatives and asking them how they were doing, and you know, kind of being really, really open with them about it. Like, it just, you know, it hit me really hard. I still remember the days over there and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and this is the grandmother on my mother's side. And so, you know, we'd already dealt with my grandfather's death a couple of years ago. He died the same year as my father. And so, you know, having all this kind of happen, it was like, oh man. So I had to kind of deal with all that. But I eventually got to the point where, you know, it almost became, you know, because you're always thinking like, oh, I don't want to bother this person with my issues and all that stuff. But I kind of eventually started bypassing that and just kind of going for the call. And, you know, I think getting that, getting yourself to do things despite the fact you don't want to do them, like with my podcast, right? Like I'm not always into talking to people, right? I always have to amp myself up, do a little meditation. Even before this, you know, I was listening to some binaural beats, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but I also know that it's important for me, if I want to continue doing what I'm doing, that I need to be doing these things. I need to be putting myself out there. And if I want to be a mental health advocate, I need to talk about my mental health to people. And, you know, that's really what it comes down to. I have an obligation now and also a passion. But I think whenever the passion goes away, the obligation takes precedent. And whenever the passion's there, they go in such great harmony. And I always know that it'll always come back. So
I think, first of all, your story is very brave to be open about all the things that you went through. Mm-hmm. And I'm always impressed by people that can just say like, this is what I went through. And just tell the world. And I think that especially being a man, mm-hmm. men just don't talk about it. So I think it's like they want to escape through smoking pot. You said it was very common that all your friends were smoking pot or, you know, drinking or whatever it is. We all do that as people. But I think the road that you've chosen to go down to be an advocate, and yeah, you might have to hype yourself up sometimes to, you know, do your show or come on somebody else's podcast. But at the end of the day, it's like what you're doing is so amazing because you're helping other people.
Oh, thank you.
And you're, you know, there's somebody out there that's either listening to my show or your show that goes, well, maybe I need to go talk to somebody, you know, and maybe before they were too afraid, or maybe they didn't understand that they were having hallucinations and what a panic attack look like, because mm-hmm. our panic attacks, everybody has a panic attack and it can come in different forms. So I just think, I always ask people, so you said a few minutes ago that you're spiritual. Mm-hmm. Do you still consider yourself spiritual? Do you pray? Like, what do you, how do you talk to God?
Yeah, funny enough, I actually was at a prayer group. We do a prayer group. I used to go to a church back in Saratoga, which is next to San Jose, and now they're doing all Zoom stuff, obviously. And so I was doing a prayer group right before this. But, you know, I even my podcast was somewhat inspired by that. I eventually got to the point, because my YouTube channel, if you look at the very first videos, it was just vlogs of me talking. It was me reacting to things. It was me talking about like mental health and anime, because I'm a big anime fan, you know, all that kind of stuff. That was what it originally wanted it to be. But eventually I got to the point where I asked God, I was like, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. I just don't know, you know, what am I going to do with this channel? Cause this is my third channel that I'd been doing. My other one I do is Anime Casuals. This is Mental Health Casual. I do another podcast called Casual Bro. So I'm casual all over the place. And so, you know,
casual. You're not dressy. You're not dressy, Lucky. You're casual.
Exactly. And so, you know, I eventually got to the point where, you know, I was just like, what am I going to do? And, you know, I don't really want to talk to people, but then I kind of shifted the thinking again. And I was like, oh, what if these are all God's people or all God's children, right? Even though you may hate, you know, you may have times where you hate your brother or sister or your cousins and all that stuff. Eventually, it comes to the point where you can either keep hating them or you can start loving them. And I think that's how I had to start thinking about it, because we all have different viewpoints. We may not agree on certain things, but if I could see people as God's children, I could see them as, sometimes I feel unworthy of talking to people. Like Dr. Ney was a really big step up in talking to people at that point. Once I figured out who she was, I actually didn't know who she was when I invited her on my show. I just kind of saw, oh yeah, I just looked up depression on YouTube and I was like, oh, Dr. Ney's talking bar. Cool. I'll do that. Let me get in contact with her. And she said, yes. So I was like, okay, cool. Let me look into her. And I was like, oh,
she's the best. Crap. She's
yeah.
The best.
Yeah. And she definitely made me feel very welcomed on that. But I had to kind of change my, you know, the way that I was looking at this into, I need to really understand. And if you want to think about it as like a puzzle, right? You know, that without all of the pieces in place, which I think all of us kind of make up, and that's why I always tell people whenever they're thinking about suicide or anything like that to reconsider, just because for the plain fact that even though you may resemble somebody in some way, you might be doing something somebody else is doing in some way, they still can never do it the same way that you do it. They can't do your whole life the same way that you do your whole life. Like, even though I'm going through this and we have similar, you know, mental illnesses
journeys.
Or, you know, mental health journeys, you know, even then it's still not the same, you know, you have kids and all that kind of stuff. I eventually want kids, but it's still not going to be the same. It's not copy and pasted over to my side. It's just not how life works. And that incredible story in and of itself, if you want to think about it as like a book, nobody could ever write your book the same way that you wrote it, you know? And that's really the important part about our lives, is that we really, we're unique in our own way. And so if you take that away from the world, it's like taking a puzzle piece out, and it'll always have that, it'll always be missing that piece, you know, that piece that could have had there.
100%. And you know, I think you're pretty fabulous, and I hate to be really corny right now, but I'm going to be corny. I feel lucky, get it? Lucky. I feel lucky to know you. And I know Dr. Ney does too. And I will tell you that I'm very proud of you, because you're very brave to do all the things you are to try and help other people. And I think the analogy of a puzzle is amazing, because our world needs your piece of the puzzle. So in closing, keep living, keep praying, and keep growing.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Our family has grown. Welcome to the world, Hannah baby. Introducing a new collection, Hannah Soft, made with Tencel. It's so breathable, with stretchy comfort for all of baby's first moments. And it's cool and gentle on their skin all year round. Entrusted Hannah quality for your most precious gift. Hannah Soft, made to last. Shop now at hannahanderson.com.